Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Once again, it is time for our weekly Q&A with Layla. And Layla, we're into October now. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I can't believe so fast. And now holidays are around the corner.
Hey, but that's why we live here in the brutal northern latitudes, is to enjoy the change of season. You know, I grew up in Southern California, and Southern California, they would have like all the tinsel and, you know, the shining stars and Christmas decorations and Santa Claus, and it'd be like 85 degrees. You know, so this is like they would put tinsel on the palm trees, and that's like a soulless Christmas. It's not really,
I don't think I've ever been in a warm climate during Christmas.
Okay.
So that's just completely strange to me. Yeah.
Well, maybe anyway. One of these days, maybe we'll have to go down to Brazil where it's Christmas is in the middle of the summer.
South
of the equator. So anyway, this is our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. We've got several of them today. You can get your questions to us via radioprogram@AOL.com. We invite you to take part. It's a way that you can get your most important medical and nutrition issues hashed out. This week, Layla, I notice one of the big stories that is making the rounds. Last week we talked about depression as an inflammatory disorder. This week, it's a new theme. You know, we often say it's not your fault, you're fat. You know, yeah, there's some moral hazard involved, but there's a lot of genetics and there's a lot of external factors. It might be a glandular disease involving the thyroid or, you know, some form of high susceptibility, insulin resistance. But this article really is making the rounds here. Chemical exposure linked to rising diabetes and obesity risk.
Oh, yeah.
So help us out with that one, because I know that you know a little bit about how this can occur.
Chemical exposure, the so-called gender benders or the endocrine disruptors, these xenoestrogens or estrogen mimics in our environment, in our plastics, which contain bisphenol A and phthalates, in all kinds of other products and things, and all our exposure to even food and, you know, pesticides, additives, preservatives, all of these things can behave as endocrine disruptors in our body, making us fat. And guess what? These are also called, to some degree, obesogens. We haven't used that term in a while, obesogens.
Yep.
And what happens with these toxins is they tend to be stored in our fat.
Yes.
So.
So at precisely, you know, at the very same time that you want to lose weight and say, you know, through your dietary efforts or your exercise efforts, you're mobilizing some of the fat that's stored in your adipose cells, and that fat spills into your circulation. And that fat is laden with toxins that were otherwise sequestered in your fat cells. And it's speculated that this may be one of the reasons why it is so difficult for some people to lose weight, because as soon as they begin mobilizing the toxins interfere with their mitochondrial function, prevent efficient burning of calories. They come back and circulate, because you don't see them when they're stored in your adipose tissue, which is actually one of the reasons why, you know, eating, you know, like whale meat or something like that, it's often very high in chemical content and heavy metals, because the fat is a repository for some of these toxins, especially in large-bodied animals, and I guess humans qualify on that scale. And we can, all the toxins that we consume from poor quality meats that we consume, poor quality water, even things seemingly as innocuous as cash register receipts are laden with bisphenol A. It's also found in food can linings. Phthalates are found in plastics and cosmetics.
Right.
Flame retardants.
ATM receipts.
Flame retardants are, you know, they're mandated, and children are exposed to them because they wear pajamas and they sleep on mattresses that are laden with brominated hydrocarbons.
And I think, you know, women are particularly at risk because they use a lot of personal grooming products that contain parabens and things and benzenes and so forth, and as well, you know, using nail polish removers and makeup.
Yes. You know, it's funny.
I
got a haircut yesterday, and, you know, I have problems because I had a bad hair day yesterday. It's super humid.
It's been rainy.
It's really humid. I mean, it's terribly humid here in New York. It's kind of that fall transitional weather. My hair was standing up on end. So I asked my hair care professional about, you know, some kind of product, you know, to, you know, get my hair to behave. And she told me about a product, and, you know, went to the cash register and checked out, and it was $30. And I said, and I thought to myself, you know, that's quite a lot of money, but imagine being
that's
a woman. Imagine being a woman, because I buy, I buy shaving cream and razor blades, and that's about it. I don't have to buy lipstick, nail polish, you know, makeup, any of those things.
Exactly.
Imagine how much money a woman spends in her entire lifetime on all these products, and how much potential toxin exposure they get from applying this to the skin.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we absorb much more through the skin than we actually ingest, you know, orally. Especially things like the aluminum from our antiperspirants and things. But our lotions, our sunscreens, all of that, they're laden with toxic chemicals, and this is all, you know, bending our genders, so to speak.
Indeed. And in fact, specifically when it comes to weight, you know, and then I want to get to questions, but the threat is particularly great when unborn children are exposed to endocrine disrupting chemicals. Animal studies found that exposure to even tiny amounts of endocrine disrupting chemicals during the prenatal period can trigger obesity later in life.
Wow.
The endocrine disrupting chemicals directly target beta and alpha cells in the pancreas. Those are the cells that are responsible for secretion of insulin. So when their capacity to secrete insulin is affected, then blood sugar control is out of kilter. And then, of course, fat cells themselves get hit by endocrine disruptors, and liver cells. So this can lead to insulin resistance and an overabundance of the hormone insulin in the body, which is a key risk factor for eventual type 2 diabetes and then heart disease, stroke, and even cancer. So there you have it. And this is, it's a pretty strong statement. Not your fault, fat. It may be environmental exposure.
It's a great argument for detoxification from time to time. But the other thing is, anyone on a weight loss diet, I think it should be just mandatory to be on some very good supplements containing high quality antioxidants to help you through that, because as you said earlier, all those toxins are being released into the circulation as we shed fat.
And that's actually engineered into one of our products that we promoted at drhoffman.com. It's the Core Restore system, which puts you on kind of a cleansing detoxifying program, but it offers you the nutrients that enable your body to properly detoxify, because if you starve yourself and then release a lot of toxins in your system, your liver is overwhelmed and it's not supported, then bad stuff can ensue. So anyway, that's making the rounds this week, and I thought I'd share it. I will be discussing it further on our weekend radio program, Intelligent Medicine, so listen in, and I also post this stuff on Facebook. This week, an article on allergies. It's fall, and allergy season is upon us, so lots of ragweed in the air, and big rains this week in the Northeast and Midwest, all along the Atlantic seaboard, and that means mold will start to explode as part of the fall extravaganza of allergens. And so there are 14 specific supplements that I recommend, along with additional tips on how you can beat fall allergies. Check it out at drhoffman.com. Subscribe to our newsletter, because we've got weekly timely information. I try to make it seasonal so that it's appropriate. Okay, without further ado, let's get to questions.
Okay, we've got a question from Peggy that's kind of broad, Dr. Hoffman. How would you treat someone with Lyme disease?
Okay. Well,
that's a podcast.
Well, that's a series of podcasts. It's very variable. You know, Lyme disease, the complexity of Lyme disease is that, you know, if it were a simple infection, then the usual regimen of 21 days of doxycycline would be perfect for everyone and everyone would be cured. And that is the case sometimes, but all too often people have residual symptoms. And the residual symptoms could be due to any one of several causes. I actually did a very excellent podcast, I believe it was this summer, with Dr. Leo Galland, who's an outstanding integrative physician, and he's recently turned his sights on to Lyme disease, and he has a very, very comprehensive approach to it. But in that podcast, he shared that, you know, number one, there could be recurrent infection, or there could be persistent infection, because we know that they're antibiotic-resistant organisms. They sometimes hide deep within the recesses of the body, and so it may require additional antibiotics to treat a patient who's still sick after an initial Lyme disease infection. In addition, there may be an aftermath of Lyme disease not related to an active infection. It may be that there's residual genetic material or antigenic material that's left over after Lyme disease has been eradicated. The persistence of that material may set up an autoimmune reaction in the body. That's another possibility. Another possibility is that the damage done by the Lyme organism doesn't simply go away when you kill it. You know, it's sort of like the analogy that I sometimes give is if an arsonist sets a forest fire and they capture the arsonist, does that necessarily mean that the fire goes out? And the answer is no. He's set the fire. I mean, certainly he's not going to pour more gasoline on the fire. That's all to the good that you capture the arsonist. But still, the fire may persist. And so we need, in some cases, natural treatments to quench the inflammation in the joints, the inflammation in the brain that causes brain fog and memory problems, depression.
Dr. Hoffman, what role do biofilms play here? Is there a role?
Well, there is a role, possibly, because biofilms may be responsible for the majority of infections in the body. That's a whole other topic. But biofilms are actually communities of bacteria that hide within mucopolysaccharide layers that render them less susceptible to antibiotics. And this we clearly see in periodontal infections. We see this in chronic otitis media, ear infections. We see this in chronic sinusitis.
But not necessarily in Lyme.
It's not clear. Some people allege that that's the case in Lyme. But, you know, and then, and finally, you know, there are also the devastating effects of the treatments themselves. So some people, after a series of antibiotic treatments, they become weak, sick, tired, more allergic. We know that clearly there's a linkage between antibiotic use and allergy. Recently, it was found that there's a linkage in women who take antibiotics more than five times in a year. It was about a dramatically higher, I think it was 30% higher risk of diabetes. We know that when we give animals antibiotics, they become bigger and fatter. That's agriculture takes advantage of that to produce you know, more poundage in their livestock.
You know, agriculture uses antibiotics specifically
for growth,
necessarily to keep the animals disease-free, but
exactly.
to fatten them.
Exactly. So anyway, so it's such an essay question, and you know, where does conventional treatment end, and where does natural treatment begin? I think you need a concerted approach to the patient with Lyme disease, and you know, unfortunately, it may require judicious application of conventional antibiotics, but at the same time, we need a lot of nutritional support. So, and you know, there's a lot of controversy about Lyme disease. There are people who are really conservative about handing out the diagnosis of chronic Lyme disease. They say most patients who feel sick after Lyme disease, they have the aftermath. They don't actually have active infections. And then there's some you know, particularly forward-looking integrative physicians who believe that antibiotics really have to be given long-term to patients with Lyme disease. And I got to say, I'm not even sure what the answer is, because antibiotics have very harmful effects. And we don't like to unnecessarily dose patients with antibiotics. So it's it's a conundrum. It really is. It's a, and, you know, and of course, the other thing is, because the symptoms of Lyme disease are so legion, you know, you could say, well, is ALS due to Lyme disease? Is dementia due to Lyme disease? Is, you know, are, you know, all the over 60 folks walking around with painful joints, are they actual sufferers of Lyme disease? Could it be that that's what, you know, and to the point where Lyme disease sometimes becomes the whipping boy for virtually every kind of health problem that a person has, and I think that's a little over the top.
Yeah. So this is ever-evolving.
Yeah. I wrote a book on Lyme disease in the 1990s, which talks about the natural support for Lyme disease. It's still available in print. It's a complex subject.
Peggy, thank you very, very much for your question. We hope you feel better soon. Okay. We've got a question from Janice. I recently had my blood pH checked by my doctor, and it was 7.75. What could cause this, and what can I do about it? Regarding diet and supplements. Don't do anything, Janice. That's what your blood pH is supposed to be, slightly alkaline like that.
Right. I believe, actually, the correct level is about 7.41, give or take.
Yes.
Is perfectly neutral, neither acidic nor alkaline. Our blood is supposed to be slightly alkaline. 7.7, you know, actually represents maybe a little out of the range towards alkaline. But, you know, I question the accuracy of the test because it's very hard to measure the pH of the blood. It can be done, but it has to be done not with a vein stick. It has to be done with an arterial stick, which is usually very painful. And, or, you know, I think they have maybe newer methods for doing this, but you have to access the arterial circulation and not just, you know, draw blood from your elbow. So, you know, first of all, I don't really like this paradigm, this notion that, you know, we'd use the blood, the saliva, the urine to determine if a person is too acidic or too alkaline. It's too simplistic. An example of which is that if you have very alkaline urine, your body may actually be very acidic. It may be that your body is inappropriately secreting excess alkaline, which your body needs to counteract the acidity. So it doesn't actually reflect what's going on in your body. We would have to actually look at the tissue itself deep within the body to see if the body is alkaline or acidic. Typically, people who are very sick, you know, critically ill, they become kind of acidic, partly because they're not breathing well, partly because they're not eliminating toxins well, partly because, you know, they're just not metabolizing well.
Certain medications, no question. More acidity, besides diseases. But
even metformin, you know, which is a pretty, you know, glucophage or metformin can cause lactic acidosis.
And, you know, urine pH, just to talk about urine pH for a moment, you know, after you have a very green smoothie in the morning and you test your urine pH, you will become more alkaline. But, you know, your body eventually after a few hours will shift back into homeostasis, which is a little more neutral. Mm-hmm. And generally, the pH level of urine is somewhere between 4.5 and 8, generally. And this, again, has nothing to do with blood pH, which is very, very strictly controlled. Your body will eat itself to maintain the blood pH. Otherwise, we would die.
Right. So if you think that just because, you know, you have a green smoothie that you're going to alkalinize your body, it isn't necessarily the case. From a dietary standpoint, there are some surprises. So something that's very acid to the tongue, like lemon juice, actually reads alkaline in the body. It's net alkaline. Animal proteins are somewhat acidic, but actually studies have been done of cultures that are hunter-gatherer cultures, where they consume, you know, they hunt for wild game, they consume a lot of animal protein. But generally, these cultures actually have a net acid-alkaline balance that is more towards alkaline. Why? Because they don't consume a lot of refined foods. They don't eat white bread. They don't eat bagels. They don't have soda. Soda is one of the most acidic things. Soda is one of the most acidic things. It actually contains phosphoric acid, and then the sugar generally promotes an acidic reaction in the body. Mm-hmm. And so,
Nature took care of it for us. Our alkalinizing foods are produce. Our vegetables are fruit. That's what our Stone Age ancestors had. And the animals they killed were the acidic source. So it was balanced. But the newer foods to civilization, dairy, agriculture, grains, all of that kind of thing, even beans, these are acid-forming.
Right. And also, the other misconception is that it's desirable for everyone to be alkaline. And the answer is that no. It's actually, if you're too alkaline, generally, you might be more predisposed to allergies, hypersensitivity to environment. And if you are
kidney stones.
Yep.
On either end of the range, urinary alkalinity or acidity is a risk factor actually for kidney stones as well.
Yep.
So the mid-range is always desirable.
And we don't measure it, but sure ways to make sure that your body has good acid-alkaline balance. Eat a varied diet. Eat a lot of plant foods. Don't eat refined foods. Exercise, because oxygenating your body has a lot to do with expelling things that might promote excess acidity and promoting circulation, because if there's poor circulation of the tissue, you develop acidity in your tissues. These are some of the things.
Metabolic acidosis, metabolic alkalosis,
But it's really complicated, and it's been, I think, bastardized and oversimplified by the natural community. You know, I have to say that there's much about the natural community that is laudable and admirable, but I got to call it when I see it that people are trying to oversimplify a complex problem, offer patients feedback, which in this case is meaningless.
I agree. Janice, thank you very much for your question, and don't worry about your blood pH. It's taken care of whether you want to do something about it or not. It's very, very tightly controlled.
Yep.
Okay. We have a question from Marlene. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, thank you both for being there. Can you offer any help for my son, who's a professional singer, who suddenly presented with throat discomfort and a gravelly sound in his voice? The endoscopy led to a diagnosis of GERD, but he doesn't have a sensation of reflux. However, his vocal cords are red. So, of course, the doctor gave him a prescription for Prevacid, but he doesn't want to take it.
Right.
He was told to avoid spicy foods, which is good advice.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else besides PPIs that he can do?
Well, yeah. Actually, we saw a patient that really reflects this kind of problem just yesterday. And Okay, this is thought to be kind of an innovative thing, is that we take patients who go to the ENT, the ear, nose, and throat doctor, because they have throat problems, and we convert it into a gastrointestinal problem. We say, you came to me as a doctor focusing on your throat, but actually your problem's in your stomach. So we're going to give you an acid blocker, and you'll be fine. Well, that works about 10% of the time. The vast majority of times, it doesn't work, and not only that, it can exacerbate the problem, because when you disrupt the pH of the gastrointestinal tract, here's where pH is important. It's supposed to be acidic down there. When it's not acidic, you can get bacterial overgrowth in your small intestine, SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth. That will cause belching, upchucking, and that makes the problem worse. So actually, there's a new term for this condition. It's called LPR, laryngeal-pharyngeal reflux, which actually doesn't respond well to acid blocker. It's now recognized. And it's a poorly understood condition. It possibly has some allergic components. It possibly has some infectious components where in the slime layer, and we were talking about biofilms earlier, the slime layer that coats the oral cavity and the throat, harbors bacteria or even yeast, which may promote a reaction by the tissue causing reddening. I mean, yes, with a singer, there could be some vocal overuse. One of the treatments that can be helpful for singers is intravenous glutathione. It actually really works. And why would that work? Well, it's a potent antioxidant. antioxidants seem to make a difference in helping with you know, inflammatory problems, vocal overuse issues, and you know, glutathione and N-acetylcysteine to some extent are mucolytic; they break down excess mucus. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
what about DGL?
DGL, absolutely. That's you know,
that can be very soothing.
That's soothing. That's the deglycerinated form of licorice. You know, taking aloe. Although, you know, this is in the. It's just not in. This is in the larynx, not in the where you know your food is generally not going down the larynx.
Right.
So if you gargle with aloe, it's not entirely sure that that's going to get into your larynx where it needs to be. It, that's more helpful for your esophagus, for actual GERD where there may be some esophageal reddening or burning. So you know there are actually. People who specialize in working with musicians. We've interviewed here in New York a Dr. Benjamin Asher, who has actually a large clientele of musicians and vocalists.
Mm-hmm.
And he uses intravenous glutathione. He's an integrative ENT. And that's, you know, I think he's really nailed down some useful techniques for getting patients with vocal problems well without medication. And you know, there's also some a form of something called vocal rehab, which is teaching. You know, you yourself are a musician. You know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Janis Joplin would have been a little tough to you know maintain a long career the way she screeched and screamed. And you know, sometimes you need to learn a new way of utilizing your vocal cords.
Singers understand that you're not supposed to sing from your throat without causing. Some discomfort or anything. You're supposed to sing up in your head, but that's all about singing lessons. That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, but there's actually there's a center at Lenox Hill Hospital in New York, which is center for physical therapy and rehab for musicians. So, you know, violinists who have problems with their fingers and hands, you know, horn players who have problems with you know, lips, jaws, they learn new ways of performing that enable them to continue their careers. And same thing with singers. There's a whole science of doing that. So,
wow.
All right. Now, this is a good point at which to pause because we divide our podcast into two parts.
Mm-hmm.
So let's stipulate this as part one. So in part two, give us a preview of what we're going to be talking about in part two.
Yeah. Are there any supplements that mimic ACE inhibitors to help control blood pressure?
Indeed. Good question. We'll take it up in part two of today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, today here with Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mutin. We'll be right back.